This is the OBcast, the audio program of Near Earth Object. It's long-form conversation with interesting people who have unique perspectives about society and culture, humans and objects, and the world in which we find ourselves. I'm Paul Fidalgo. This is episode 4, recorded August 25th, 2013, and today's guest is Ken Kennedy. You sound like you're coming in from space, but I can hear you.
Dang it! Internet connection problem. Is everything all right?
I'm hearing you fine.
Okay, good. It was just some little...
Wait a minute. Did Windows give you an unnecessary notification?
Oh my God. No, Skype
did. I can't believe it.
I actually think, Ryan, I haven't listened to the most recent one.
Mm-hmm.
Was that... Oh, Kylie.
That was Kylie, yeah.
I'm in the middle of Ryan's right now. I was literally listening to it running earlier. And he brought up the, status anxiety? Mm-hmm. I think that would probably be the manifestation of us. Like, yeah, it's that status anxiety thing. I'm like,
You're right. That's exactly what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
And you don't even know him.
And I don't even know him.
Like, yeah. He's not even in your social circle and he's not a colleague of yours.
Nope.
And yet, because you have this ethereal, at best, connection, you know, at digital audio through me.
Exactly.
Like, removed by 2 weeks, you feel like you need to measure up to whatever it is he or whatever these folks have been doing.
Yeah. Oh, it's fine. Oh, trust me. This was literally 2 hours ago, and I was sitting there listening to it and thinking, I don't need to be listening to this right now. This is just going to, like, toss fuel into the fire of the gives me a name for what's actually running around in my head right now. I'm like, bygones, no worries. But
okay.
But no, I'm glad we got to do this. I'm really excited.
I am too. My goal is to make neither of us sound like assholes.
That sounds good. Yeah. I have no problem with that.
Yeah. This is not journalism by any stretch of the imagination.
That's fascinating to me to hear people talk about that sort of thing. Well, and one of the there's a difference in what you're doing with some of the other podcasts I listen to, in that this is, you know, almost every time or every time so far a conversation between two people. But I've gone through listening to certain other people that do podcasts that I listen to start out in a position where they do very, very heavy self-editing. You know, because they're clean out every little and every cough and they've gone to the point where over time they're like, if I'm going to keep doing this, yeah, that ain't going to happen anymore. they've kind of slid. Now you're in a different situation because you've got two people, and like you said, people can talk over each other and things. But it's just interesting to hear, you know, how people's you know, ideas about their podcasts or the not the effort even. I'm not saying that it's an effort or lack of effort thing. It's just what they're comfortable with,
right?
Changes right. Over time.
Oh, and you know, I remember there was a piece on, I think it was on the Media, it's an NPR show that I like.
I like that show. Yeah.
Oh, it's a great show. And one of them was they exposed how heavily edited NPR is generally, and it was astounding. Like, you always assume there's some cleaning up going on, but they edit the crap out of that stuff. And not only do they edit it, but like even on like Car Talk when that was on, they would insert extra laughter from the two hosts about particular jokes they had told each other to make them sound like they were funnier than they actually were, you know, to hear them laughing more, that kind of thing. So I feel like if NPR can do it, then we're cool.
Oh, that is interesting. I mean, that's one of those things that is like perfectly obvious, you know, if you do any sort of media stuff in retrospect, but if they're skillful at it, you literally have no idea if you're coming at it, you know, without knowledge of what's presumably going on.
Yep.
I need to, do they have a podcast of On the Media?
Oh yeah. That's where I listen to it. Yeah.
Cool. I actually usually catch it on Sunday afternoons in the car. I think it's a Sunday afternoon show.
It might be.
And if I'm listening to NPR, well, basically the only radio I ever listen to anymore is NPR. I would listen to On the Media, and I almost always like whatever's on. So
yeah,
I need to stick that into my podcast rotation.
I will find that episode and put it in the show notes.
Ooh, I like.
Yeah. So let me just say out loud now, since we are recording, I'm talking to Ken Kennedy. Ken, how would you describe yourself? Because very often when I have a guest on here, it's pretty easy to say who they are. Like when Ryan was on, I say it's Ryan Kornowski. He's the deputy editor of Climate Progress, because that's kind of his marquee thing. Now, I know that you work for Turner, but yep. I don't think that's necessarily your identity. You know, I am Ken Kennedy, a guy who works for Turner Broadcasting, but maybe it is. So how would you, if you had to sum it up, how would you describe yourself?
I use the usually the little tagline that I use, and you may have seen this somewhere before, but I like it. I use it is on the social medias and such. I usually consider myself an overly idealistic geek, and I've also started tagging a recovering libertarian onto that. So,
oh, we'll get to that. We'll get to that.
I figured okay. You probably would, but that's my and yeah, I do work for. I work for Turner Broadcasting. I'm a database administrator, so I'm a database geek.
Okay, now I should say I have no idea what that really means. You sum it up in some way that someone who is very dumb would understand?
Yeah, so database administrators, and I do everything from the very big, so you might have heard, like Larry Ellison runs Oracle mm-hmm. Corporation. Second largest software company in the world. And their big product is Oracle, which is a database platform. You know, databases, basically their whole job is to store data. And that sounds simple. You're storing data, you're trying to keep it safe, keep it consistent.
Organized.
Never ever lose anything. What's that?
Organized.
Correct. Yep. Yeah, they're built to make things safe, make it, you know, fast for you to be able to get it back, never ever lose anything, all that sort of stuff. Primarily at work, a SQL Server administrator. I also do some Oracle work. The open source products, so you probably heard MySQL. You ever heard that?
Yep. I've never known what it is.
MySQL is the big relational database in the open source world. It's not actually my favorite. I've actually done twice, gone through the... It's kind of the Betamax. I don't know if you know the Betamax versus VHS thing that happened in the 80s.
I am aware.
Yeah. So one of them was technically superior and one of them was easier to use and spread out more and became the champion.
Oh, now I've heard that. Now, we had a beta when I was a kid. And right. I heard that it was because porn was more readily available on VHS. And that's what did the deed.
That is probably true, because that's pretty much always the case. Yeah, wherever the porn goes is right. Where, yes, I can totally see that being the case. I don't know if there's more porn in MySQL than PostgreSQL, but it's probably, it could be true. But in the open source,
I'm glad you thought of that. That's good.
In the open source relational database world, there's MySQL. And then, and again, these are just labels, but some people will know this. And then there's a database called PostgreSQL, which, especially back, say, 10 years ago when they were both kind of coming up, it was definitely technically the superior database. MySQL was not, but MySQL was much easier to use. It was easier to just kind of stick it up there and get it running. And so it became, over time, by far the most popular of the two. I liked Postgres better. But I do them. I run them both. I can do both things.
You also, I check your Twitter profile, and I know that you don't use Twitter as much. Although I kind of feel like I'm goading you into being on there more often, if for no other reason, just by at replying you a lot. You list yourself as a tech activist. What do you mean by that?
But so tech activist, and I would still consider myself that. I'm not as hardcore about it as I used to be. With age, you just get not quite as hardcore about most things, you just kind of, but do you remember, you're quite a bit younger than me.
How old are you?
I'm 46.
You are?
Yeah, I am.
I didn't know that. I thought you were maybe like 2 years older than me or something. Mm. I'm 35.
Yeah, I thought you were around mid-30s. And that's not a big deal, but.
You're very youthful, Ken.
Oh, thank you. But do you remember people talking about the old people talking about mm-hmm. the crypto wars in the 90s?
Around the campfire, Grandpa would tell us stories while roasting marshmallows. and he's telling us stories of the crypto wars. No, I don't really know much about that. That it kind of rings a bell for maybe something I've read referenced in some Neal Stephenson writing, but no, I don't know much about that.
I was getting into the internet around the time, like I started playing with Linux in probably 93, 94, you know, using very early versions of Mosaic, the like pulsing Mosaic logo I remember very well. And the and you may remember these as well, but I was, you know, 20 something. I was already.
Yeah, I remember them existing, but I wasn't into it yet. Yeah.
But so and in that period of time, the guy who wrote the crypto wars were mainly about the export of cryptographic, of like secure cryptographic tools out of the United States. The Clinton administration was pretty upset with Philip Zimmerman, who's the guy who wrote PGP, Pretty Good Privacy. And you may have, like,
yeah, I'm, you know, I actually know the name, but that's about as much as I know. Yeah,
PGP has never been completely open. It was kind of semi-open for a while, and it was a proprietary product. And now there's the Free Software Foundation wrote a interoperable set of software called GPG instead of PGP. They flipped the letters. That does the same sort of thing. But during that whole period of time, Philip Zimmerman was allowing people outside of the United States to grab PGP off of his website. And the government got pretty pissed about us letting strong encryption software leave the country without being, you know, monitored and all this sort
of
thing.
This was not government property or anything, though.
No, no, no. But no, there was actually a set of, gosh, I can actually almost reach the t-shirt that I used to wear.
I love that you have a t-shirt that has anything to do with this. That's fantastic.
I have a t-shirt. I have a t-shirt. This is from probably 96 in the middle of the crypto wars that, in particular, the problem was exactly, it's a free speech issue, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, you can't restrict people from doing this. And in fact, the government never tried to restrict if you had a program in a book, so that it was typed out, you know, whether it was in C or Python or whatever, it could be BASIC, it could be in any language, but that is protected by the First Amendment. The source code actually of the program, which is protected by the First Amendment. But what the government wanted to do is apply, I believe they're called the ITAR, and I can't remember, it was International Trade in Arms. And so it was basically the same set of rules that we used to say, you can't export M1 Abrams tanks to Iran, because that's, you know, that's like a munition. That's like a, you know, or some sort of crazy missile, right? You can't send those out of the country without us authorizing it, because what if you sent it to, you know, and this is back really before the terrorist thing was such a big deal.
Right.
It was more like Iran or China or whatever. They wanted to apply that same set of rules to encryption software. And again, it wasn't the source code. It was the actually like compiled the program, being able to download the program over the internet. And that's what happened. That was right at the time where all of a sudden the internet blossomed, and now somebody, you know, halfway around the world, we're completely used to it now, but it really was kind of novel in the mid-90s that somebody in, you know, Angola could surf to this website of this guy, Philip Zimmerman, and download this piece of software that gave them perfectly secure communications that even now today we think, we're pretty sure, that the NSA even can't really get at.
But just to be clear, they could always just get the book, as
exactly.
It were. They could, like, someone could mail them the source code or something like that,
or
could they put it in an email and send it to them, or something like that.
They could even download the source code as a file from this program, and then they'd have to go through the onerous process, and it is a little annoying, but not that much, the onerous process of compiling software, which, you know, is like semi-magic to most people, you know, especially
it's magic
people.
To me, it really is.
Yeah. Well, it's magic in the sense that I could send you the recipe for said magic and you could do it, you know. It's there's no difference. You know, it's like, if you're going to restrict this, then you have to restrict that, or you haven't restricted anything. And our government, you know, looked at that and blinked and said, okay, I see what you're saying, and I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to still restrict the software and say that it's perfectly okay to send the source code anywhere in the world because we have a First Amendment.
Now, what is that? Is that the government not understanding the difference? Or what is the thinking behind that? Because that seems mind-boggling to me.
I wish I knew.
Was it more just a message like, we'd rather you not do this, and so we're going to have this rule?
I don't think so. I think it is a fundamental, not the government, because there are plenty of smart people in the government, but I see the same things in big corporations, not mentioning my own, or just in general. You reach a point where someone is a position of authority and they are not, because this is a technically oriented subject. And sometimes it's not technical. Sometimes it's legal, for example. Sometimes there are legal questions that I don't exactly understand. And I have to have somebody explain to me a little bit. But once they explain them to me, I'm like, why are they having this argument about that? You know, it's like really bizarre. But someone in authority is trying to make a decision about a technical thing, like the fact that there is no difference between source code and compiled code. And I guess at some point, literally the person there doesn't get it. They're just ignorant. They're ignorant of the topic, and yet they have the power to make the decision, and they make it the wrong way. That's the only thing I can think, because
it sounds like you've just described Congress.
Well, yes, because I think it's frequently, you know, the copyright issues that we deal with, or patent. Oh my gosh, the whole patent thing is just insane at this point. I'm like, I've almost stopped reading articles about software patents because, you know, they just make me cry every time I look at them. Like, this makes no sense whatsoever, you know. But and I'm sure the people in the trenches are like, what we're doing makes no sense whatsoever. Yet we've been given these rules, and this is what we have to go by. You know, it's like, to go back to the activism and the I was fairly fairly libertarian at the time. So I was, you know, in my like hyper-political phase, and I considered this whole argument ridiculous, this whole source code and compiled code thing that we've been talking about. And I loved this T-shirt, and I got it involved in all this stuff. And that's when I joined the EFF then. I joined the ACLU like 3 days after 9/11 because I was like, oh, this is not going well.
Oh, we're going to need you guys. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't realize the EFF had been around that long.
Yeah, no, the EFF is actually, were there during the crypto wars, and they actually were, I could look it up, but I'm going to go from memory, and if
that's okay,
a few things wrong, then people will, you'll get follow up, and you'll be able to
sure,
read it on other episodes and go, Ken said such and such. But one of the first major, because I know there's some other stuff it touches on, the game stuff that I have done and continue to do. I played role playing games since the early 80s, you know, Dungeons and Dragons, the classic beginning one. But in the late 80s or early 90s, one or the other, there's a company called Steve Jackson Games that makes both role playing games and they also make board games. And they had their own role playing game system. The name of it was GURPS. It doesn't really matter, but it wasn't exactly the same as Dungeons and Dragons, but it had similarities. And one of the things about GURPS is it was kind of universal. It was like you had a set of rules, and you could plug in your scenario or your background. So they had a fantasy rule system for GURPS, and they had a space rule system where you're flying around in space rule system for GURPS. And then they had a GURPS, because remember, this was, like I said, late 80s, early 90s, and the cyberpunk genre of science fiction was a big genre. And so GURPS came out with a cyberpunk role-playing game setting. And the cyberpunk role-playing genre involves, like, you know, hacking into computers and, you know, usually with literally, like, electrodes plugged into your head, of course.
Mm-hmm. But we're still talking about a pen and paper roll the dice.
Yeah, this is a pen and paper role-playing game. Exactly. But they described hacking in the book. And one of the people who was involved in helping them design the book was of interest. I mean, he was of interest to the FBI because he knew He might have been a hacker, or he might have been accused of hacking. He was like somebody who had been in that like real world pseudo hacking genre, right? Mm-hmm. The FBI knew his name. Long story short, because of this guy, and the FBI found out that Steve Jackson Games was writing this cyberpunk setting for their game that involved hacking computers, pen and paper role playing. Steve Jackson Games was raided by the FBI. Their computers were seized. This is back in the early 90s. Their computers were seized. Their assets were frozen. Again, this is a game company. You know, they almost went out of it. They had to end up laying off almost everyone that worked there. They almost went out of business, very close to just disappearing entirely. And the EFF, that was one of the first cases that they actually took on.
Okay.
People on the EFF board knew Steve Jackson or knew of his plight or whatever, but it was one of the very first cases that the EFF got involved in because they were like, this is beyond ridiculous and insane. This is a pen and paper board game about stuff. You know, it's like, that would be like, you know, shutting down a publisher, Dan Brown's publisher, because what he had Digital Fortress, you know, one of his, I think it was actually a book he wrote before the Da Vinci Code that talks, you know, cryptography and everything and breaking codes and like, oh, we're just going to shut down, you know, Dan Brown's publisher because he published a book on, you know, hacking. It's like, it's the same thing, except of course, Steve Jackson, you know, didn't have nearly as expensive lawyers. So,
right.
But he survived through it and got through
it. See, that's fascinating because coming from where you're coming from, now, you know that I think libertarianism is on the whole pretty nutty. But, you know, given that context of you're coming from a context of folks who are technically savvy, who are immersed in computers and in cryptography and in this all this subject matter, and to have a government that either, A, completely doesn't understand it, and is making rules that really hinder it, and B, seem to be almost hostile to it, I can become very sympathetic about the idea that folks in the tech industry would be libertarian inclined if this is their experience of what government overreach is.
Yeah, that is very much the feeling that came out of that period, very much so. And that really, shortly after I graduated from college, I really got into political history stuff. And so I started reading about utilitarianism and libertarianism and then the weird like anarcho-capitalism and all that sort of stuff and found it compelling a lot for a lot of the reasons that you're exactly describing, the whole, you know, they do not understand us and they're trying to, you know, to come in with rules that make absolutely completely no sense. And you know, change or shut people down, just, you know, the whole coercion thing I was big into for a while. And so that was very much kind of the mindset I had at that period. And I think it matches. I mean, you know, you'd have to talk to people, but people like John Perry Barlow, who's one of the founding members of, or one of the board members, I think founding members of the EFF, he's got a famous thing, the Cyberpunk Manifesto. And it's this whole, you know, we throw off the shackles of your authority because we live in cyberspace and you do not understand us. Blah. It's that very whole kind of libertarian.
I know you're truncating it, but that sounds like the tinfoil hat kind of stuff.
Oh yeah. There's certain extent it very much is.
Gotcha.
But it's a very naive libertarianism, I think. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where, you know, I went through and lived in that world without thinking about things too hard, you know, for a pretty good while. I'll admit, and I used to admit this proudly, and now I kind of admit it like sheepishly, that I voted for the libertarian candidate for president, like, I'm not sure if I voted in 88, like 88 was the first year was able to vote for president. I know I did in 92 and I did all, so 92, 96, 2000, 2004 I did.
So you now describe yourself as a recovering libertarian?
I do. Yeah. I mean, I think at this point I realize that things are complicated, you know, but Whereas, and I say that sounds silly, but literally, I don't know. Have you ever seen that? I used to carry this in my wallet. The world's smallest political quiz. It's like a little libertarian giveaway thing. Oh gosh, I should send you one. I probably have one around somewhere, but it's this little you know, the libertarians make a big deal of there's this difference between civil liberties and economic liberties. So they try and take the left-right spectrum and they say, no, left-right is too simplistic. It's like a two, you know, it's like a grid.
Sure.
It's a two-dimensional thing. And so on that little, it's literally like a credit card or a business card type thing. It has five questions about economic liberty and five questions about civil liberty. And how you and so then you plot yourself in kind of a diamond shaped graph.
I think I've seen this. Yeah,
you've probably seen that.
And one of them is statist, isn't that right? Like a
yeah. World's smallest political quiz gives you 10 questions that plots how you are on that. And literally, at one point in time, and I guess I believed it at the time. It's weird looking back on it now, but I would take that quiz and I would score a perfect libertarian score.
Wow. You
know, no, couldn't do anything. And then it really, I mean, I started to grow up and think about things in a different way. Just like when I was a kid, I got more skeptical at religion, for example. Mm-hmm. But it maybe took me, you know, 20 years more to think about politics more skeptically. But a really simple thing happened to me. I had a guy, I wasn't a regular, but personal trainer sort of person. But I run a lot and I was trying to be you know, relatively physical fit and stuff. So I went to a personal trainer. I just say that it sounds weird, but I'm not like this, you know, work out all the time.
You're not humble bragging. I got you.
Yeah, trust me. But so I had this guy and he became a really good friend of mine who was a trainer, and I went to him for 2 or 3 years. And here's a guy who's super nice, has a pretty decent job. He also did, you know, other sort of work on the side and bouncer, because he's like a big, huge, giant dude, you mm-hmm. know, so a bouncer at, you know, clubs in Atlanta and stuff. Super nice guy. But of course, he's working for a little teeny tiny businesses, basically working for himself. So what does he not have? He doesn't have health insurance.
Mm.
And he got sick. And it ruined his, you know, like financial life. And listening to him talk about it and seeing him getting sick and it, you know, the time it took. And I was just like, it kind of thrust it in my face. It was like, this happens to people and this happens to regular, ordinary people. And I knew it, you know, I knew it in that generalized, you know, like this is a thing that happens way, but it took that person. And I'm kind of ashamed of it, but it is what it is. It took that personal connection, a lot of times it does with these sort of things. You know, it takes that personal connection of somebody that you know in your life, and you're like, oh, these aren't just people, you know, these aren't just like things that happen in the world. But this friend of mine was financially ruined by the fact that he got pneumonia. You know, like literally probably for the rest of his life, you know, he had declared bankruptcy, right? And, you know, and I was like, that is screwed up. And then I started looking into it, and I realized, I'm like, really the only sensible way to do this, to fix that problem, is, you know, some sort of nationwide thing that means that the federal government needs to get involved mm-hmm. in some way. And this was 2000, probably three, okay. four, something like that. So this is before the Obamacare or anything mm-hmm. like that, before that. And second of all, then I started looking around and, you know, it's been thrown into people's faces more now, but I'm like, this is a solved problem. It's not like universal health care is something that everyone in the world has always, you know, aspired to, yet no one can handle it. It's like, oh yeah, we're actually the only first world country that right. doesn't do this.
Is there a libertarian acceptable way of doing something like that? Because it seems to me that you could have a system where the federal government, yes, for everybody who needs it, we've got a system for you. If you don't want it, that's fine. Go into the free market and get what you really want. But if you don't want to do that, I mean, does that violate libertarian principles that a federal program exists at all, or just that it would be dominant?
And I should actually go back and look at that. I would be interested in seeing if there, if the fact, for example, of a mandate, because I'm pulling these out of my head right now, but from what I remember, the Swiss system, because you know they vary from, you know, completely government controlled, like the Brits, to, you know, hybrid systems. Mm-hmm. From what I understand, the Swiss system is probably the closest to ours, and, you know, the least government controlled, and perhaps not coincidentally, you know, the second most expensive after all, even though it's still only half of ours per capita, but still,
yeah,
you know,
we take it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That'd be a pretty good number. But what I understand, that one is, I want to say it's all private insurers. I could, again, this is all off the top of my head, so I could get this completely wrong. I think it's all private insurers, and then people under a certain, you know, income are subsidized by the government to purchase. But they're, you know, everyone's required to have it. It's I think it's all private. And so you would wonder why a libertarian, you know, what they would have a problem with. You know, and I mean, if you get to like an anarcho capital, you know, like the I want the police force privatized sort of libertarian,
mm-hmm.
you know, they don't want the government, you know, they don't want the government really doing anything. So I'm sure they would be upset about the fact that the government was helping out, you know, somebody who makes minimum wage to get their insurance. But, you know, that's, you've actually given me some homework here. I need to go and see if there is a model, what libertarians think about that sort of thing.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure they would balk at a mandate. I mean, I'm sure that would be, yeah. you know, untenable, but mm-hmm. I wonder if just the idea of one existing that was, you know, robust and cheap and, you know, easily accessible, if that would be a problem for folks. Cause I have trouble sometimes putting myself, in the libertarian mindset. I used to be very sympathetic to it. Mm-hmm. But as you get older, you start to become more aware of the nuances and the contours of society, the context of history among different classes and races, and why we are where we are. And you realize that this kind of rudderless system is a recipe for disaster, because it just doesn't acknowledge the facts that surround our very existence. It seems to me, anyway.
Oh, no, I totally agree. It was like, it's weird that whole, what is that quote? You know, if you're, when you're under 30, if you're not a Democrat, you have no heart. And if you're over 40 and you're not a Republican, you have no brain, or something to that effect. You know?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
And I've looked at that and I'm like, that's, you know, actually kind of weird, because I actually did it the other way. You know, it's like, as yeah. I get older, the nuances of how complicated life is and how things, it's like,
Well, we are in an unfortunate stage politically, I think, in history. We are at a stage now where pretty much anyone who is interested in actually governing has to be a Democrat. You just don't have a choice. Like, even if you are ideologically vastly different from other folks in the party, if you're actually just interested in making the government function, you have to be in the Democratic Party, because the Republican Party, right now, their entire existence is about upending it, or yep. or if not completely upending it, then directing all of its power toward the betterment of an extremely tiny percentage of the population. I think it's always been somewhat directed toward that. I think it's always been a very patrician party. It's always been about helping the upper echelons and big business.
Sure.
But it's really kind of focused in the past 10 years or so into really just helping out a tiny, tiny sliver, and everything else has to be detonated, essentially. Yeah, and so libertarians and Greens, you know, all really have, if they want to be relevant, they have to live within the Democratic Party. I don't think libertarians have a home in the Republican Party like they think they do.
I agree with you there. The Republican Party at this point is bizarrely dysfunctional to me.
Yeah.
It's strange.
It apes libertarianism. I mean, I think Paul does a good job of pretending to be a libertarian, you know, in the purest sense. But you can't, I don't feel like you can seriously call yourself a libertarian with that kind of, with the ideals, with the intention behind it, which is real liberty, real freedom to be who you want to be, and work within a system like the Republican Party, because it's so it's not really about freedom. It's about directing resources toward one particular sector and, you know, hammering folks with things like, you know, radical Christianism and things like that. And that seems to me to be completely antithetical to what the idea behind libertarianism is. And I could be wrong about that, but that's my understanding.
No. I mean, that rings pretty true to me. I mean, there are interesting, and again, it's been a few years since I've been involved in it, but most of the, I'm sure there are new lights in the Libertarian Party, but most of the, like the hardcore, you know, the books that people pull back, you know, and go over and over again are decades old at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And the, like the religious question, for example, is been, it's one of those things that I think there were elements in the party that were kind of more, I guess, Republican, just religious for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously when you're religious, you pick your religion as the better religion.
Right.
And there were groups that pulled in that direction, even while trying to, you know, go with this liberty, you're free to do what you do. You know, you're free to do what you do as long as you do it the way I want you to do it, sort of thing.
Right.
And then there were it's, in other words, it's always kind of been a tension and an argument within the party is how you deal with this religious question, I think. And I certainly agree with you in that the Republican Party may be aping. I think that's a great description of it, aping it, but certainly within that religious question.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Ron Paul is a great example. I mean, he's very much a Christianist, and it's interesting to see. And I've written about a lot about this before. I find it frightening how appealing he is to liberals because of his positions on civil liberties and on foreign intervention and things like mm-hmm. that. And I totally get that. And he's also kind of charming and folksy, and he's got that kind of, you know, I'm the honest old man appeal. And I totally get yep. that. But he's also radically right wing on cultural issues and on establishing Christianity, mm-hmm. you know, and I wonder why folks don't notice that, and they don't realize that, you know, I know he was in the party before, but he's not, that doesn't sound libertarian to me.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you there. He does have that folksy charmingness. Heck, Charlotte's walking by now, and I think
hi Charlotte.
Paul said hi. And I think I told you that we went to you know, a couple of the, or both of the Republican Party debates.
Yeah, I want to hear about that too.
In South Carolina. Oh my gosh. And Charlotte was, she was bound and determined to get her picture with Ron Paul. And he was, after one of the debates, he was leaving, he was walking off, he was being taken away by his handlers, really, because he was actually pretty willing to go out and press the flesh.
Mm-hmm.
And he was being taken away, and Charlotte reached up and put her hand on his shoulder and said, "Please." And he turned around, he shook off his handlers, he turned around, and we got a picture with him. It was, and she says the same thing. She's like, I know he's crazy. And you know, these things that he espouses that yeah. are just like, no, but he's like, he's so cute.
He is cute. he's adorable.
He's like a little elfin, you know.
Right.
He is. He's like, he is cute. But yeah, he's
like, oh, your ideas are so cute, Grandpa.
Oh,
so, you must never have power.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but maybe, I mean, I said something that now I'm kind of regretting. I said the idea that if, you know, that yes, Greens, if they want to be relevant, have to have a place in the Democratic Party. Libertarians, I guess, because again, I feel like the only party that's serious about government actually functioning is the Democratic Party. But I guess you could argue that a Libertarian Party, they want government to function, but they want so much less of it that maybe they're just homeless. Maybe there's just absolutely no way they can stomach being part of a party that fights for, you know, a mandate of universal health care.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I like that one. It really is. I mean, like I said, that,
or just believe strongly in using taxation and progressive taxation.
Yeah. I mean, that it's almost like a no-brainer sort of thing to me. Yet. These people want to fight you against it, but mm-hmm. you know, the universal healthcare thing, I've gotten to the point I'm like, it makes me cranky. Mm-hmm. I'm like, come on, folks. I mean, we are the richest, most powerful country in the history of the world. Let's just fix this. Let's just make sure that...
Yeah, it's just so obvious that we need it. That's what's always kind of astounded me, is the denial of the need for it. The repeat from Republican folks who are always saying that we have the greatest health system in the world. And you just have to think, like, what health system are you looking at? Maybe yours personally is great, I'm sure, but... But if you just look around you, it's so obvious that something needs to be done, and that, you know, less regulation is not the thing that's going to keep these poor people from losing their lives.
I mean, I had a friend of mine who I love him. I mean, one of my best friends, and we love to go. He's a good enough friend that we could go politically, you know, hammer and tong.
Mm-hmm.
Republican, like involved in his county Republican Party and all that stuff. And when I talked to him about my he knew I was libertarian, and when the whole thing started changing, I talked to him about my my trainer, and he's like, well, you know, he could have gotten health insurance. And I'm like, dude, I'm on personal health insurance. Well, first of all, you know, there's no, you know, the pre-existing condition issues. Mm-hmm. And I'm like it was like, well, if he really cared about it, I'm like, okay. I'm like, you're just not living in the world that, like, other, you know, we work for a giant mega corporation. We get insurance as part of our, you know, but guess what? We get our salary and we get insurance. And yeah, we grumble about how much money we have to pay for insurance every month, but it's a fraction. It's a small fraction of mm-hmm. what these people are being charged for, much, much, much less, you know, less useful insurance. And then, we are guaranteed all pre-existing conditions. You know, it's all this stuff that happened as an artifice, you know, as something that happened during World War II, because there were wage controls during World War II. So they couldn't raise wages. And so, you know, the government said, yeah, guess what? You can use insurance as a benefit. You know, so they threw it in there, and they allowed corporations to use insurance as something that they could effectively raise wages by when they couldn't raise wages. And now that's been bundled into, you know, the fabric of everyday life in the United States since then.
Yeah. And it's really complicated.
It's like, but I'm just looking at him and I'm like, you're going to have somebody in your life have this same problem before you understand this, probably, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. All right, so you're a recovering libertarian. Is there – because that doesn't tell me that you're now a full-blown Democrat. I mean, the Democratic Party makes me nauseous all the time. so is – what are you still sympathetic to libertarianism for? Like what still appeals to you about it that you're not saying forget this entire thing?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, if you're a recovering – I mean, I'm pretty – I'm just not afraid, you know, or not I'm a little abashed about.
That's a good word.
I was like ashamed that didn't work. It was abashed. Yeah. I'm abashed at like presenting that as something that's in my past. I don't want to like bury it and never mention it again. But and I'm not a I'm
you
not
came
a,
by it very honestly.
And you know, I'm not a card-carrying Democrat, but I'm not a card-carrying anything. But no, I hear what you're saying there. I would say keeping an eye on like federalist like regulation in particular. Depending on the I think there's a dependency on like the industry, for example, mm-hmm. or the sector of the world that we're talking about. Sometimes that stuff can get, I guess, overblown, for lack of a better word. But I really am kind of stretching at this point to figure out where I describe myself as a recovering libertarian versus just a progressive or a Democrat.
Mm-hmm. I presume you're socially liberal.
Oh, yeah. All those.
Most things.
Yeah, I scored 100% on that one already. Mm-hmm. So good on that.
You sound like you agree with progressive taxation, and that's a pretty fundamental thing. You like universal health care. I don't know, Ken. You kind of sound like a Democrat to me. I hate to break it to you.
Yeah.
Except maybe it's about it's still something embedded in the tech world that kind of makes you hedge.
that could actually be it. And just in the sense, and I don't think it's actually, I was just sitting here thinking about it with you. I actually do. And I have some places, describe myself as a progressive.
Mm-hmm.
And, the tax thing was something that I kind of thought through after the, after I kind of the dam was broken with the healthcare thing. And yeah, I have absolutely no problem with that either. And I think part of the issue may be taking on the label of, and I realize that the Democratic Party is not, or the, is not the primary cause of the absolute gridlock. You know, well, it's in fact, you know, they're not doing much of it at all right now.
I would call them a hapless victim of the gridlock, you know, the inept, blundering mess that cannot deal with the actual perpetrators, which is the Republicans.
But I would say, I guess I don't want to, I'm just a little reluctant to take on the label of anybody that's like actually labeled. Mm-hmm. Congress right now is so disappointing to me.
Mm-hmm.
That I try not to think about it because it literally makes me angry.
I like, completely sympathize.
Like, I cannot believe what is going on. I'm just like, you know, you go through that, like, let's just throw everyone out. And you're like, that's not freaking going to solve. And I'm like, I don't know what to do. I literally don't know what to do.
It's like, yeah, beyond like a new constitutional convention, I can't even imagine at this point.
Oh, and trust me, whole Lawrence Lessig and his root strikers and stuff that have talked about that exact thing.
So, okay. Is he maybe the figure that you would align yourself most with politically?
That, I have a huge, huge amount of respect. Yes, if I had to pick somebody, I could pick Lessig without hesitation.
That rings pretty true. And he is also an influence on me in my keynote/PowerPoint presentation style.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. He is amazing.
All right. So we'll do a little more politics because I am interested in you did attend both Republican debates that took place in South Carolina. There were only two. Why would you even want to go to one of these things? I mean, I would because I'm nuts and I eat this theater up. But why did you want to go?
Similar reason. I mean, this last debate, and they keep saying they're not going to have as many next time, and I'm like, oh, that sucks so hard. I'm like,
please. Oh, no way. That's the best part. Are you kidding? Like, that's the reason that people paid attention to this election was this clown show series. I mean, I know that they probably think it hurts them because they all looked so ridiculous, but man, that's what got people engaged was those ridiculous debates.
They were amazing. And, you know, I was watching them, you know, watching every one of them. Charlotte was watching them. If I was in Atlanta, I mean, like I said, she lives in North Carolina. I live in Atlanta. We re-met on Facebook after knowing each other in high school. It was one of those. She was like my first crush that I never went out with her. Oh, yeah, yeah. It's one of those. And we reconnected and now we're married. Yay.
That's good. Beautiful.
Yeah, I know. Cry a tear. I love this stuff. You know, I eat it up too. And in particular, I like it anyway. I'm a political wonk, period. And then this is like a clown show is an excellent, you know, description of this. Oh my gosh, these things were insane. But oh man, there were characters. It was like, this is South Carolina. It was, these people were, it was just like old school. You know, looking, it was like every caricature of a, you know, Southern Republican that you can imagine was there. It was just like,
were there people in white suits?
Yeah, there were people in white suits, actually. There were.
And bolo ties.
Oh, it was amazing. Yeah. It was amazing. It was so much fun. And then we get like taken as a group and walked into the, walked in, and literally we were probably 40 feet from the stage. We were in like fifth row. Newt Gingrich's daughter and grandson were like two seats down from Charlotte, sitting in the same row with us. And this, and the one, the Wofford College one was, that was everybody. That was Herman Cain.
Yeah.
That was the whole nine yards. That one had everybody and their brother in it. It was
the whole bucket of crazy.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so yeah, what is it like to be in the room when these things are actually taking place on TV? It almost plays like this. It almost looks like just a farce, like a farce is happening on television, like some kind of sitcom. It's so, you know, surreal.
The people there are so serious about it. I mean, I'm sure. I guess there must have been someone else there like us. I'm surely we weren't the only people that were there for the entertainment value.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, because my experience of these debates is mostly watching it with my wife and with people on Twitter, and we're all just laughing our asses off, essentially, and you know, with a trace of horror and fear, of course, but
sure.
But yeah, so in the crowd you're surrounded by true believers.
Yeah, well, though there was an interesting split. There were the Ron Paul fans and the non-Ron Paul fans.
Ah, yes.
And that was like a bit, because Ron Paul would say things and you would see there was a group of people sitting right behind us that every time he would like speak a word, they were like standing up and clapping. Mm-hmm. And literally they were getting like the stink eye from other people. You know, the other people were like, you know, just that was the biggest separation within the group.
That is interesting, because on television you know, if you're educated at all in this stuff, you already know that the people who are cheering are the Ron Paul people, and it's not necessarily the entire crowd, but it is kind of melded together on television. You don't really get that sense of like there's a faction of people over here versus a faction of people over here. It just sounds like there's people in the crowd who are cheering, and it kind of can give you the impression that the Republican Party might be trending in this kind of anti-interventionist direction, which I don't think is the case.
Oh, yeah, no, I don't think so either.
So you went to that one, and then you went to one in Myrtle Beach, and it was whittled down by that point?
Yes, yeah. Well, Myrtle Beach was interesting because it had definitely whittled down by that point. And we got there the night before, and we had gone out. We were kind of wandering about and ended up having dinner and drinks in this kind of pub bar sort of area, sort of place. And we were in this place and we were sitting in one point and we looked around the corner and I was like, oh my God, those are all like little young Republicans over there. Mm-hmm. Like we have to move closer. So we go over and we start, and it turns out, yes, they were guy, it was in Lindsey Graham's office and a couple other people, and they were all working the convention, right? And that was the night that, and so we started talking to him, kind of just, you know, chatting with him and everything. And that was the night that Huntsman was still in the race, and then he dropped out, like literally mm-hmm. that night, the night before the thing. And I get like the New York Times trending stuff, you know, beep on my phone. And so, you know, it beeped on my phone and I showed it to Charlotte, and then I showed it to one of the guys. And it turned out that part of the group had already heard about it. We were one of the guys that we were talking to, like we were the person that told him. He was like, no, Huntsman's in. I'm like, no, look, he's out. And he was like, oh my gosh. And the whole group was talking. It was like, it was fascinating to see these little, you know, 20, you know, 3 year olds that were just so into it. And so like ideologically like wrapped up in it. And I was just like, oh, I remember.
They couldn't have been pro Huntsman. That's almost certainly.
Oh, no, that one, no, they totally were immediately were like, oh, that's fascinating, you know, that's going to give us a better, you know, like they were trying to figure out the political angles and everything, and it was fascinating. And then that one was much more like, at the first one we didn't even walk through a metal detector walking into the place,
right?
We walked in as a group, you know,
it was still a circus at that point.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, in Myrtle Beach you're like metal detectors and it was all serious. And
it's like, okay, one of these guys might be president.
Yeah. The debate probably there wasn't quite as good. I really liked the free for all with Herman and the whole group. But yeah. But I tell you what, I will do it again. I've already told Charlotte we have to book that whole thing.
That's great.
If you're within shouting distance of one of those things, the Republican debates are amazing.
It sounds terrifying. Well, you know what we should do? Is, you know, assuming the Obcast is still up and running at that point, we should have you like do like a special correspondent kind of thing. You can go you can awesome. Record some audio, you know, find some crazy people. It doesn't have to be candidates or anything like that. Just find some crazy people saying crazy things and we can put it on the show.
We will totally do that. That's awesome. That is done.
Awesome. Okay, well, speaking of which, what an excellent segue that is. So I first became introduced to you because you had somehow found my music. I don't remember how. And you put it on what was at the time your podcast. You asked my permission, and I was like, oh, my God, I don't know, my little music on your podcast. That's great. Thank you so much. And that was extremely flattering. And so I knew that you were kind of doing a regular podcast thing, and then you stopped for a while, and now you're doing this Dog Days of Podcasting project, which is 30 days, you do one every day. Is that the idea?
It is, yep. And yeah, I got yours, I believe it was off of Amy Street. Do you remember that?
Oh, right. Oh, I miss Amy Street.
Amy Street was awesome.
That was great.
That was crazy. It was like, for people who don't know, it was like, you could find music, and music got more, it started out really cheap, and it got more expensive the more people bought it.
Right.
So as people got, or so as music got more popular, it ended up at it pegged at 99 cents a song, just like, you know, every place else did. But you could go through and you could find like things that had recently been, you know, uploaded or whatever. And I found some actually pretty good music. I mean,
oh yeah, it was a fun place to discover stuff with like no investment.
Oh, you want to hear a funny story?
Yeah.
I may, and you could also, you could share the music. There was a way you could actually make money. You could make money for your account, your Amy Street account.
Yes.
Off of the music.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, I came in, and I used to go in and kind of look for things that were like trending, you know, because I was like, oh, I'll make a little bit of money. And I went in one morning. I don't know when this was, 2007. We could tell from the event, but
yeah, something like that.
2007 or so, and I'm looking for something, and I found this music, and it's not terrible, but it's not anything fascinating, but it's trending. It's trending, but it was trended from like one penny, which is where everything started, to about 8 cents at that point. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, oh, what the heck? I'll do whatever the thing was. I don't even remember, to like share it to my groups or whatever, and like jump on this music and see what happened. And this was like a morning before, right as I got to work, and I closed it, didn't look at it again. And then we got ready to go to lunch, and I went in and looked at it, and this music was at like 89 cents or something. And I already made like, I mean, it's not a huge amount of money for, but for Amy Street, it was a huge amount of, like, I made $50 or $60 off of this of like,
oh,
80
wow,
credits. And I'm like, what the heck is going on?
It's like a stock market.
Yes. And I finally figured out that it was, and again, I don't have computer windows open, but you're going to get this, so I'm not worried about it. The Attorney General of New York, who had
Spitzer.
To resign. Yeah, Spitzer. It was the woman, the escort, that Spitzer had gotten involved with. She had an Amy Street account, and she was a singer. And
that's fantastic.
It was her music. And I had no idea. Until, so finally I'm like, I'm Googling her name or whatever, and all of a sudden I'm like, oh my God.
You benefited financially from the downfall of Elliot Spitzer.
I did. On Amy Street. Although I was able to buy like 300 songs with that money.
Right, you know, right. Okay, so you have a history then of podcasting. But
I do.
And so I've listened to it a bunch of times, and it's not like you don't have a formal structure to it. It doesn't sound like you don't, you know, you don't have regular guests or have a format that you stick to. It sounds pretty much like I'm describing it for you, and I shouldn't, but it sounds like you're almost like a diary.
Yeah. I consider it, I didn't really know exactly what I was going to do when I started it. And I kind of frittered about, I had a couple of episodes like, when I had your music on there, and I think I had one other guy where I considered doing, okay, this is music that I like. And I've done a couple of times, and this is mainly back even before the Dog Day stuff, where I was talking about books that I'd read recently or stuff, but I never had a formal formal structure to it. And there's a tech guy, I won't be surprised if you don't know his name. His name is Dave Weiner.
I know the name.
Yeah, he was pretty early on in the blogging stuff, and Dave, and we've like informally emailed a few times. I don't know him. He wouldn't know me, but we have emailed back and forth a few times, like, you know, back in the early blogging days. Mm-hmm. And he has described before a blog as like, I believe he calls it the unedited voice of the author. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what I've thought of the podcast as. It's like almost an easier way. I like the blog doesn't have a lot of structure, but it has a little more structure than me just clicking record and starting to ramble about, you know, what happened this day or this week or whatever.
Sure. And not to go on a tangent, but I would argue that maybe that's how blogs started. It was that kind of idea, but now they've evolved into more of a less formal news article or opinion piece or essay, whereas the unedited thoughts of the author are now appearing on Twitter.
Oh, absolutely. And Dave makes that point as well. He kind of rails. He doesn't like it, but he's like, you know, he does admit that is what it is, you know.
Yeah.
It's like they have definitely evolved since then. Yeah.
Yeah.
And for me as well, because even my blog, you know, I spend, you know, I do way more posts. Heck, I do more posts on Twitter, much less, and I do.
Well, it kind of depends on what the purpose of it is. And I struggle with this with my own site, is that I try to write every day if I can. Lately, last week I was sick, everybody. Give me a break. You look at sites like John Gruber's site or Andrew Sullivan's, which are kind of rife with these kind of link posts where person X says X, link, the end. And that's the entire post. And, you know, I don't post frequently enough to just allow myself to have that kind of filler. If I'm going to post, I really need to have, you know, something to say. Or I feel that way sometimes. And so I feel like the challenge is to decide, what is your blog for? What is the purpose of this product you're making, be it a blog or a podcast? And so I'm curious what you see that as. Mostly I'm talking about your podcast, but about your blog as well.
Yeah, I mean, my blog way back in the day, and I don't even have my blog. I think it stops on my site currently at about 2003.
Mm-hmm.
But I know I was blogging in 2000. I think I was blogging in 99. But I did several back end database-y sort of, you know, back to the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the data is still there, and I actually have all those old hard drives.
Good.
And I am able to recover those blogs, because I remember blogging, for example, right around 2000 or right around 9/11, and going, this is not going to go well. We are going to overreact. You know, that's like I said, I'm like, I just joined the ACLU because
that would be some great stuff to recover. Yeah,
I really need to get that stuff back.
Now, you were in very rare company, though, because it's not like blogging was a common thing in 1999.
Yeah,
I don't think I'd even heard the phrase at that point.
It was pretty uncommon back then. But again, I was in the little tech nerd group at that point, you know.
Right.
Yeah, the little techno-libertarian sort of thing. I guess that would actually be a way, because I would say the techno-libertarian, other than that, it's not a, you know, official phrasing,
no,
but
we'll take it. Yeah.
Yeah. But that is a differentiating description of it, because that group of people, you know, who came from it mainly from that technical point of view, often if you scrape hard enough, you eventually get to, as I have, you get to some different philosophical stuff way deep underneath than the pure, you know, Ayn Rand anarcho-capitalist libertarian types. So, but I used my blog, you know, early on. I made plenty of technical, like, nerd posts. Oh, this is what I'm doing with, you know, such and such code or whatever. But I've, especially after 9/11, for a while, I mean, I wasn't always, like, writing huge, long pieces. But it would be a little more than a link post. You know, it would be, like, a paragraph or two about something. But the whole civil liberties thing's been, you know, a concern or a thing that I paid attention to for a long time. And, that's kind of where my blog went until it kind of started to fritter a bit. The podcast, I'm still thinking about that. This Dog Days of Podcasting has been really, I'm really glad I bumped into it. It's through a buddy of mine, who was deciding to do it. And, some days have been, very easy, and then some days I've struggled a bit. So I haven't put together a structure yet, but I'm kind of starting to see something coming. That's, you know, I don't think I'm going to do like an interview show or anything like that. So I think it'll be me.
So I understand that you're trying to let the form kind of find itself as you go. So you're discovering a structure, for what works for you. But what is it you're trying to accomplish with it? Is it you know, just self-expression? You just want to be able to find an outlet for your thoughts? What is it you're trying to produce?
I think it's basically an outlet for my thoughts, and mm-hmm. and to be able to I've shied away from political discussion. The level of disillusionment with our current current, it's not just Congress. I mean, it's the, you know, administration as well, is like, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know how we're going to make the changes that we need to make. And this isn't huge. This isn't like giant steps. I'm not expecting, congressional convention would be great. Or constitutional convention would be great, but I'm not expecting that. I'm like, there are ways we could fix this stuff that, you know, are not huge,
right?
But they are not happening. Something has to change. But, and I guess in a sense, you know, maybe you should be out there, you know, saying what you're going to say and trying to get things changed.
Yeah. See, I feel like what I would have to say might be almost too conventional. I mean, you know, that's has nothing to do with, you know, whether I think I'm a good writer or anything like that. It's more to do with where I see myself, you know, within the spectrum of things. Like, it's pretty much understood that I'm going to be pushing leftwise in some way, shape, or form. But your concern sounds more like where you are politically is too small. So maybe this is the argument you're about to make, that maybe you need more, you need to be one of those voices, so it adds to the volume of whatever is already there.
Yeah, I guess this has actually been helpful in kind of working through that whole, like, giving form to my idea. But I guess I do. I mean, I've gone through phases in my life where sometimes you, like, relax a little bit and say, oh, I'll just kind of be annoyed with things, yet go with the flow. It's happened at work before. You know,
work within the system, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. And then sometimes you just have to not do it.
So I get where you're coming from then politically, but then it still becomes a question of, because it was more about the podcast itself, you know, why you choose this particular format. Because it's not as though I don't see you heavily promoting it, for one thing.
Oh, no.
So it's not like I've got this brilliant, you know, nugget of political wisdom, and I've put it in a podcast, and I want to make sure people hear it so it'll change the world. I don't feel like that's what you're trying to do, you know, necessarily. Like, you know, not to say that you're not trying to be part of the conversation, but it doesn't sound like you're doing activist podcasting and hoping to, you know, intentionally make some kind of impact. It does sound like it's more internal, like you're working it out for yourself. Am I on the right track?
I think you are. Yeah, actually, that makes a lot of sense to me as well. You're helping me work through this,
well, good.
This form as well.
It's like therapy, this show, is what it is.
Oh, yeah, it is. It is like therapy.
I'm doing this show with no illusions as to the number of audience, and that's, you know, you know that I tell the folks who I've invited on, there's like five listeners, and I can't quite explain it myself, but for whatever reason, I feel like a good use of my energy and intellectual efforts and creative output is to produce this podcast product. I don't really know why I feel like I need to do that, but it feels like it's a good, productive, creative use of my time, and I like what I've made at the end. Like, it's, you know, I can, it's like I've put my model ship together, and I can be proud that that's there. Is that kind of where you're coming from there? Because you and I are both in the same place where we're obviously not, you know, troubled about audience numbers.
It's not a huge effort on my part to do it. So if I can make, you know, if I've got 10 subscribers, that's, you know, 10 people that are interested in hearing what I have to say, and that's fine by me, you know. So I've never been too concerned about that subscriber number type thing.
Right. And it's so antithetical to what I feel like I've always felt about my internet life. I've always felt like, you know, I need to raise my followers on Twitter, and I need to, you know, get more retweets, and I need to check my blog stats and see if I'm, you know, hitting certain levels and getting, you know, and becoming, quote, more established as a, I don't know, internet celebrity D-lister or something.
Right.
You know, I was definitely prone to that. not to say that I've, you know, completely let it go. Believe me, I still check those stats, and I still would, you know, I'm an actor, you know, at heart, and that means that I'm an attention whore at heart. But I think, again, here we're talking about it again, with age, and realizing, you know, that we have limited time and limited energy, particularly when I have two, you know, small children and whatnot, you know, you have to be focused about where you're using those limited resources. And even though I have, like I said, no illusions that there's going to be a big audience for this, it still, it feels like a creative imperative. Like, it's, I'm going to make the thing whether people hear it or not.
I can totally understand you there. And that's, and it's a good point. I didn't even think about the difference between this and other outlets. I kind of consider it the most personal thing.
Hmm.
It's certainly letting me, things that bounce around in my head all the time anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm finding, and certainly after this Dog Days of Podcasting 30-day thing, I'm not going to do them every day.
Right.
Because that's rough. But I'm thinking pretty hard about doing it once or twice a week. I don't think that'll be a big issue. And I've got enough stuff usually bouncing around in my head that I think if I stop occasionally and write some notes down, so that I don't completely go into the ramble fest mode, that I'll be happy with what I accomplish with, you know, one or two podcasts a week.
Right.
And if anybody doesn't, you know, anybody listens, that's cool. And if they don't, well, you know, that's cool too.
And, you know, before the internet, or at least, you know, before the, you know, before it became the mass medium that it is today, we probably wouldn't even have this conversation about a different medium. Like, if you were someone who was a diarist, you wouldn't necessarily be concerned with anybody ever reading it, let alone many people reading it. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, I did little, you know, audio sketch shows that I would make up on, you know, a little audio cassette. And, you know, the idea wasn't to show it to anybody ever. You know, no one would ever hear these things. They were just for my own amusement. But I find myself in the age of the internet saying, like, well, why would I bother doing this if it's not going to have hundreds of people listening? Which was never a question you would ask yourself, you know, 25 years ago.
True.
Okay, well, it's getting a little late, but there was you're totally coming back, by the way. I'm totally going to do another show with you at some point, because there's a million other things that we could be talking about. But there's one thing that's just that's on my head that I've got to talk to you about, and I've actually talked to you about it a little bit online before.
Okay.
And I'll ease us into the subject. I saw that you're reading The Name of the Wind, the Kingkiller Chronicles.
I am.
Book. I've read that one, and I'm in the middle of the second one, and I'm a fan. I'm totally digging it. Are you digging it?
I am digging it.
Okay. Now, we're not going to talk too much about that. But you're aware of the cover of this book.
I have. Well, I'm reading on the Kindle.
Me too.
So the cover's teeny.
But you've seen it.
I've seen it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, to folks who are listening, obviously, it's the cover is this kind of gaudy looking muscle bound figure with wind blowing and fabric flowing across him. And it's kind of I would say it's overblown but typical of a lot of fantasy books. Cover art, would you say?
Yeah, I've seen it. It's in the cheesy fantasy cover art world, but I have seen cheesier. But
yes,
but it's definitely in there. Yes.
So my thing is, this is a really good, nuanced, clever, grounded story. And you know, not perfect, but a really great book. And there have been other books that I've, you know, that I've really been into in the, you know, sci-fi fantasy genre. And their cover art is always this kind of overblown, overdramatic, maudlin, saturated, embarrassing, cheesy, campy stuff. And it drives me nuts, because I feel like, now this is where I'm coming from, not being a devotee of sci-fi and fantasy, like when I discover it, and I like it, that's great. Like, I good stories is good stories. Right. But I'm not, like, totally into sci-fi books or totally into fantasy books or anything like that. And I think part of the reason is those freaking covers. Is that they look so ridiculous to me that I find it hard to believe, and I know it's judging a book by its cover, but I find it hard to believe that what's inside could be any value. And I'm wondering what you think about that.
It makes me really laugh. It's a
You're a devotee
things.
of the genre. Yeah. Oh, I mean, you've read a lot of sci-fi and fantasy.
Yeah. I'm a bigger sci-fi than fantasy, but that's like 60-40. It's sure. Not like 9-10 or anything. The couple of things that makes me think, I mean, literally now that I think about that cover, it literally does have that almost, I mean, there's no woman on it, but it has that Harlequin romance-y.
It does.
Look to it, like, you know, of the character. I mean, it's missing the woman, but other than that.
Don't you feel like it totally misrepresents what's inside that book?
It really does. It really does. That cover is probably, I think we, the science fiction fantasy geeks, have kind of been trained. You totally brought this to my attention, and I'd never thought about it. I think we're trained to that sort of cover.
Fascinating.
I think that those covers are designed for us. That is totally the sort of cover. Not necessarily. I mean, I wouldn't be averse to it, but I'm okay with it. Right. That's totally the sort of cover that my buddy would pick up. That's weird. I hadn't thought about that. I think those covers probably do a disservice to the story.
I would think so. Now, maybe there's a chicken and egg thing, because I want to know, like, so if that's true, if your theory is true that you're just trained to it, and that's why, you know, the folks who consume this on a regular basis just know to expect this style, and mm-hmm. and so they just think within the confines of that style, I can buy that. But I want to know, like, where the chicken and egg is. Like, is it because devotees of sci-fi and fantasy genres are just more open to that style, or is it because it was just marketed that way from the get-go and it's what we all just got used to?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I
don't expect
hope.
You know that.
Yeah, I want to hope, though. Well, it makes me think back to books in the 80s and the 70s. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know.
They're terrible, know, those covers.
Yeah, you know, yeah, and I think back, you know, those are all books that I have physically, so I have the covers. And, oh, gosh. And some of them are. There's a particular, a very bizarre author that I really like, but he's weird, named Jack Chalker. I don't know if you've ever read anything by him, but he had one or two authors that did a lot of his covers, and they were very much of a type, and they weren't exactly the same as that cover, but the mm-hmm. similar sort of, like, now that I'm thinking about them kind of stepping out, trying to step out of the genre, I'd be like, why would you ever pick up that book?
Right.
Wow, that's this is really interesting to me. I'm going to have to think about this.
Now, yeah, I mean, I think of, like, my favorite novel just about is Anathem, Neal Stephenson. And that's this, it's a muted cover, it's classy, you have to stare at it to really get what the figures and the figure and the images in the cover even are. So they've obviously chosen a different, obviously they're marketing differently. They're marketing to a more literary mainstream audience than they are a strictly sci-fi audience.
Yeah. Stevenson definitely, I mean, he is of our genre, but he has definitely almost always since very early on, marketed towards that more literary, and man, this whole cover thing, you're dead on this, and this is really interesting to me, actually.
I think there needs to be some kind of industry revolution on this.
Oh, it would be great.
Like, the whole all consumers and authors and publishers need to kind of just, like, throw some cold water on their faces and wake up and be like, guys, these covers are fucking awful.
Because there's way more people who don't read science fiction.
Yeah, and I think you'd want to. I really do feel like you turn people. You're certainly turning me off. Put it that way, guys out there in the publishing industry, all of you who are listening, and I know there's thousands of you who are listening, you're turning me off. I don't know what to pick up. You know, it's sad to say, but yeah, I mean, a good cover will certainly, you know, will give you an impression. And for example, I keep coming back to Anathem. Anathem, you know, I think gives a really. It doesn't tell you anything about the book, but mm-hmm. it sets a mood, it sets a tone of what you can expect in the book, and I feel like it matches that, you know, the kind of scholarly, mm-hmm. Smart, nuanced tale that you're going to get. That's, you know, and it looks kind of, you know, antiquated, and a lot of the story takes place in a kind of antiquated backdrop. And so, you know, it serves the purpose. It markets the book in a kind of an intellectually and creatively honest way. Whereas something like with The Name of the Wind, you think you're going to see, you're reading a Fabio, you know, advertised romance novel, just like you said. Okay, recording a new track. Okay, what happened, folks, was that GarageBand apparently hit some kind of file size limit, which I did not know existed, and cut Ken off in the middle of his sentence. But we are close to wrapping it up anyway. Ken, I think you and I agreed that there needs to be a revolution, an uprising amongst consumers and creators in the fantasy and sci-fi novel business.
Oh, absolutely, and that's going to allow them to just take over the whole entire, with relevant and, you know, not insane covers. Yeah,
it's going to mainstream the whole thing.
Man, there are a lot of good stories. A lot of good stories.
Agreed. Okay, we've covered that. Good. Period. Excellent. We'll wrap it up here. So, Ken, people can find you at kenzoid.com. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you are an avid user of Google Plus, so people should just search for your name there?
Yeah, they can search for my name there, yeah. And there's a link on kenzoid.com for it, too, because it's like a 14-digit number, you know.
And if you taunt Ken on Twitter, he will respond. He doesn't use it often, but if you @reply him and taunt him, then he will emerge.
That's right. I appear in a puff of brimstone.
Okay. Anything else you would like folks to know about where to find you online or anything like that?
Nope, that's good. It's mainly kenzoid.com, Google Plus, and Twitter.
That's where the podcast is, at kenzoid.com. It is called, didn't say the title of it, Kenzoid's Autonomous Zone.
Yep.
Which is an excellent title. And that's where you can find Ken. Ken, thank you so very much for doing the show with me. It was really great to talk to you for the first time in real life. I guess it's still not real life, but it was really great to actually have a conversation with you. I appreciate the time and thought you put into this show today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I had a great time, Paul. I really did. And it's completely bizarre to me that this is actually the first time we've like you said, we've talked and, you know.
Well, I avoid real life people. You know, I try to live online as much as I can because real life people are exhausting.
Yeah, well, you moved to Maine for a reason, you know.
No doubt, of course. It's just cold and moose up here is all it is.